for me to turn the next service over to Brother David Rice, who, as most of you know, is my cousin in the flesh. Most importantly, he's my brother in the truth. And he's going to speak to us on a subject of which I would like to know more about, and I'm sure I will after his service to us this evening. His title is Ezra. Ezra, Brother David.
Thank you, Brother Steve. It certainly is a pleasure for us to be with you, brethren, here at convention. We bring with us the love of our wife, Ruth, and also of our brethren at home in the San Diego Ecclesia that always appreciate us having, remembering them to you when we have come. Well, brethren, this evening we're going to talk on a subject that, for us personally, had been kind of a little bit of a fog for many, many years. We were aware of the fact that when Israel went into captivity to Babylon, they were to come out again, blessed by God's providence, with a decree from Cyrus that they could rebuild their temple. And much of the history that occurs after that point was rather fogged in our understanding. So, in harmony with some studies that we were undergoing, we did undergo to study the book of Ezra, which talks about the regathering of Israel. And this evening we're going to have included in our study first a review of the book of Ezra, so that we're familiar with what it includes and what occurred and some of the history of that time. And for that reason, we have a chart here that is the history of the Persian Empire, effectively, which is the empire during which the book of Ezra transpires. Now, secondly, we're going to notice in our study that in this period of Earth's history, there are two prophecies in the book of Daniel that apply during this time or start during this time. We're going to look at those, time permitting. And finally and thirdly, we're going to look at some character lessons from the book in summary that can be of help to our Christian walk. Starting out in Ezra, the first chapter, the first verse. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and put it also in writing, saying, Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he hath charged me to build him an house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. And the decree, which is rather lengthy, goes on to say that all those who wish to can go back to Palestine, and they can, Palestine is a Roman word, back to the land, back to Israel, and establish their homeland again and build their temple. Now, they were not specifically permitted to rebuild their walls, the walls of their city. That'll come later, as we'll see further on. But they were to rebuild their temple and begin their worship again. Now, he says, Ezra, who wrote this presumably, he says that this was in fulfillment of the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, because Jeremiah had stipulated that when the nation of Babylon would be destroyed, this would mean freedom for the Jews, although Jeremiah didn't name Cyrus by name. Another prophet had, Isaiah. I believe that's in the 45th chapter that Isaiah by name had been predicted to be the liberator. But however it was that the Lord impressed upon Cyrus that he should liberate the Jews, he did so. Now we know that historically, the Persian emperors were very favorably inclined to let the native peoples of their empire worship according to their preference, rather than impose a foreign worship upon them. And this is very consistent with Cyrus's proposal and his decree. History also bears a record that, compared to rulers of the ancient Far East, Cyrus was a very benevolent one. And so this is fitting that the Lord would raise up at this time the appropriate person for his services. And we believe Cyrus is a type of Christ in a large picture that brings us liberty out of great Christendom, typical Babylon, antitypical Babylon. Well, this is merely the introduction. Now, as we go through Ezra, we're going to find, somewhat surprisingly, at least it was to ourselves, that we go two-thirds of the way through the book before we ever encounter Ezra himself. The book of Ezra mostly is not about Ezra. It was written by Ezra, presumably, and the last third of the book is about Ezra. But the first two-thirds are a long span of history that preceded him. Now, Ezra did not come on the scene until approximately this time, in the reign of Artaxerxes in the seventh year of his reign, as we'll see later on. However, the early returnees returned under Cyrus's first year, about 538 B.C., and that's over 70 years later. So Ezra was not even of the same generation as those that went back early on. He was a later generation. And there's quite a bit of intervening history that we don't have accurate records of from the Jewish standpoint during this period. But the book of Ezra talks a lot about these 20 or so years, and then it talks a lot about Ezra's work. It skips over much of this area. But this area is supplied in the book of Esther that talks about King Xerxes. We'll get to that a little bit later. Ezra, chapter 1, we have started with the decree of Cyrus, king of Persia, to let them go back to their land. Now, it's almost, as far as I know, essentially universally agreed that the year that Cyrus took over the empire was 539 B.C. It's almost universal. Now, because the Persian emperors began their official regnal years in the spring, his first year did not begin until the following spring. He conquered the city in October. October 12th is the day he entered the city. So the first year would be from 538 in the spring to 537 in the spring. And presumably he issued the decree rather early. And Ezra says that in chapter 3, verse 1, when the seventh month was come, the children of Israel were in their cities. We believe that is 538 B.C. There's something else that happened the next year that's important, as we'll get to momentarily. Now, in verse 8, we read about the returning Israelites, that Cyrus, king of Persia, brought forth the temple vessels by the hand of this treasurer, and numbered them unto Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. And verse 11 again refers to Sheshbazzar that brought these things from the captivity to Jerusalem. Now, Sheshbazzar is a Persian name. Another name that we know this person by is Zerubbabel. That's a little more familiar, because the prophecy of Zechariah talks about a Zerubbabel who will build the temple of the Lord again. And Zerubbabel was the one appointed by Cyrus to be the leader of the people as they returned back to the land. He's appointed the governor. Now, Zerubbabel was appointed governor because he was recognized as a leader of the Jewish people. He was of nobility. He was of royal blood. He was the grandson of King Jehoiachin, who was the predecessor of Zedekiah. The grandson or great-grandson? I think he was the grandson. But he was of noble blood, of royal blood. So he was the one chosen. Now, if we go into the second chapter includes a long, lengthy description of the numbers of people that returned. It numbers about 42,000. We're going to skip over the second chapter. Those numbers don't have, to us, immediately a meaning, and so we're going to skip over. The third chapter, when the seventh month was come, the children of Israel were in their cities. And now it says, in verse 3, they set up the altar upon his bases, for fear was upon them because of the people of those countries. Verse 4, they kept the Feast of Tabernacles. And verse 6, from the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord. But the foundation of the temple of the Lord was not yet laid. And we read that that was laid later on. In verse 8 it says, in the second year of their coming to the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, began Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua the son of Jozadak, and the remnant of their brethren, we'll skip a little bit, and they laid the foundation of the temple. That's the point. You find that in verse 10. So, when they went back in the seventh month, that was time for the Feast of Tabernacles, and they set up the altar and their worship again. But they did not build the temple yet. They did not lay the foundations of the temple till the next year. Now that would be the year 537 B.C. However, the work did not prosper. It didn't prosper at all. It went into disrepair, so much so that it wasn't for another 20 years that the work of the temple was resumed and it was finally completed. Now, in chapter 4, we have a record of that delay. Why it was that the temple was delayed in building. Chapter 4 says, verse 1, now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity builded the temple of the Lord God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and effectively said, let's help. Well, now this sounds like a nice offer, but the Jews were very concerned about the purity of their religion. And because these were people of the land, Oh, they had learned about Jehovah. They were transplants into the land that were instructed about Jehovah, but they weren't really Jews. And so Zerubbabel and his brethren said, no, we must keep this clean, and we appreciate your offer. Thanks, but no thanks. Well, they didn't take it well. The Samaritans of the land, therefore, began a work of opposition to the building of the temple, and they thwarted it for years. And the fourth chapter describes all the ways that the Samaritans throughout the years, throughout all of these years, thwarted the various prospects of work and rebuilding that the Jewish people endeavored to do. Now, the fourth chapter is a little confusing because it doesn't say they stopped the building here and then it was resumed here. It says they stopped the building and then they wrote a letter to Darius, and later on they wrote a letter to Xerxes, and later on they wrote a letter to Artaxerxes, and it gives you the whole spectrum of their opposition. However, the temple began to be rebuilt here in the second year of Darius, and we're going to go on a little farther and make clear why this is a significant point. Verse 5, they hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Now let's jump to the 24th verse, the last verse of that chapter. Then ceased the work of the house of God which is at Jerusalem. So it ceased unto the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Here he is. There's Darius, king of Persia. And so the work stopped until the second year of his reign, 520 B.C. So that was, not quite 20 years, but 17 years or so that the work had stopped. Now, it's at that point that we're introduced to two prophets that step forward and propel forward the work of the temple. Those two prophets you know as Haggai and Zechariah. And in chapter 5, verse 1, it says, then the prophets Haggai and Zechariah prophesied to the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel. And they began to rebuild. And as the account goes on, they relaid the foundation in the second year, month 9, day 24. Now, they had laid the foundation already. It was in such recent repair, they had to relay the foundation. And then they proceeded to build, and in Ezra 6:15 it says it was completed in the sixth year of the reign of Darius. So about 4 years in building, and it was completed in the spring of 515 B.C. And then the temple was done. From that point forward, the temple was constructed, and they did hold services in the temple. Now that's important to remember, because Ezra did not build the temple. In my confused mind, I thought somehow he had something to do with it. He did not. Ezra did not rebuild the temple. He did restore it later because it had fallen into disrepair. But that work was accomplished way back here. Now, we have to take a small pause here. I want to talk just a little bit about this period of Persian history, because we're going to be relating it to the book of Daniel in just a moment, and it's important to know what kings came and went. The first king was King Cyrus. We're familiar with him. Brethren are comfortable with him. He reigned for 9 years, and then his son Cambyses took the throne and reigned for 8 years. Now we have another king that reigned, just a few months. Some people even think he was not legitimate. He was a usurper, but it's questionable. And we didn't put him on the main flow of the chart because he reigned such a small period, not even a full year, that he doesn't count historically. But he does count in the book of Daniel. We'll see that. Darius reigned 36 years. Xerxes reigned 21 years. And this is the king that we believe was the king that Esther married. Now, in the book of Esther, you'll find reference. We'll turn there just briefly. In the book of Esther, we have reference to King Ahasuerus. Esther 1, verse 1. It came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, the one that reigned over Ethiopia over 127 provinces. Verse 3. In the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants. The power of Persia and Media. And verse 4. He showed the riches of his kingdom and the honor of his majesty many days, even 180 days. Now, That's an awful long feast. At 6 months, he feasted his nobles in the third year of his reign. And you remember at the end of the feast, that's when he brought out Vashti to exhibit her, but she wouldn't comply. She was deposed, and then Esther was the replacement wife. Esther married King Ahasuerus. Well, this says King Xerxes. But they were the same person. If you transliterate the Persian characters, you could transliterate it close to something that looks like Xerxes, or you could transliterate it close to something that looks like Ahasuerus. It may seem odd, but it is the same name. But we also have historical records. We have a reason for going into some detail here. There are historical records from the Greek writer Herodotus that says in the third year of this king Xerxes, he held a great feast to prepare for a war. And this war was prepared to go against Greece, to defeat the kingdom of Greece. Now, he did that. And that's probably the feast mentioned here, 6 months. There was a real point to this feast. It wasn't only to show his wealth, it was also to prepare for this campaign to dominate Greece. Now, also, as it turned out, he lost. He lost the battle. After taking some years to prepare, in the sixth year of his reign, he lost the battle. He came back home defeated. And the historian Herodotus says that this king consoled himself with the pleasures of the harem. And with his defeat. And that's exactly, when he returned in the seventh year, exactly the year that this king Ahasuerus takes Esther to be his wife. In the seventh year of his reign. Esther 2:16. So Esther was taken into King Ahasuerus in the 10th month in the 7th year of his reign. Now, it does seem odd, doesn't it, that he would depose Queen Vashti in his third year and not remarry to the 7th year. The explanation is that he was in Greece with that lengthy and unfortunately disastrous campaign to conquer Greece that was unsuccessful. It's at this point that we want to introduce a prophecy of Daniel, which was fulfilled during this time period. Let's turn to the book of Daniel, to chapter 11. Chapter 11, verse 2. The angel that's showing Daniel a large vision of the future is going to outline the stages of world history for the next several centuries. And verse 2 says, I will show you the truth. Behold, Daniel 11, verse 2. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia. Now, if you go back to the 10th chapter, verse 1, you'll see that the setting of this prophecy is in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. That's when the prophecy was given. So if it says there will stand up yet three kings in Persia, well, that would be his son. The next one would be this. His name is Smerdis, and some people say he was an impostor, but only for 7 months he reigned. But he would be the next king to come. The next one would be Darius. Okay, let's read the prophecy again. There shall yet stand three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. Well, that would be this King Xerxes. That Ahasuerus that was so wealthy, he brought all his nobles together for a 6-month feast just to show off, as it were. That fits the prophecy. But even more, it says, by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. And he did that. Now, this was not just a common battle, a common campaign. This was a turning point in history. We have a thin book that we have read over some time ago on world history, ancient empires, and of, perhaps 200 pages in the book, it devotes an entire chapter to this battle because of its significance in world history. Now, as you know, after the Persian Empire finally fell hundreds of years later, Alexander the Great from Greece took the kingdom, and he was the next world empire. Now, had Persia conquered Greece at this point, highly unlikely that Alexander could have taken control of the empire and defeated Persia. Had Greece been defeated here in the reign of Xerxes, history would have turned out differently. And this was such a turning point battle that it was the first significant thing in Daniel's prophecy that was given to preview history. And it's so accurately fulfilled. It gives us a wonderful assurance that Daniel was no fraud, but he was an accurate predictor of exactly what would happen. Now, verse 3 says, skipping a few generations, a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And that mighty king is generations past, was Alexander that defeated this empire. And then you have, in the next verse of Daniel, when Alexander stands up, he will be broken, and his kingdom will be divided to the four winds of heaven. And you know how that happened. His four generals took the kingdom, and the kingdom was divided into four parts of the Grecian Empire. And then, centuries later, the Roman Empire came along, and history proceeded. So, right at the outset, we have, in the book of Esther, covering this period, a record of the king who prepared for battle, did go to battle according to history, lost terribly. And this was a milestone in the prophecy of Daniel to show that God had all history understood ahead of time and could predict and have under his control the results. Let's return back to Ezra. Now, in the fifth chapter, we read that Haggai and Zechariah began to encourage the people to rebuild, and they did. However, there was still some objection to the rebuilding, so they sent a letter to King Darius and said, "They're rebuilding the temple, you should make them stop." And Darius searched the archives and he says, "No, there was a decree to rebuild, let them continue." So they did rebuild. He searched the archives, he found the decree of Cyrus. They did continue to build, and that's what the sixth chapter talks about. And finally, in chapter 7, we now get to the period of Ezra. Ezra chapter 7. After these things in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, the son of, the son of, the son of, and it traces his lineage back to Aaron. He was a priest. This Ezra went up from Babylon. He was a ready scribe in the law of Moses, which the Lord God of Israel had given. And the king granted him all his request, according to the hand of the Lord of his God upon him. And there went up some of the children of Israel, and of the priests, and the Levites, and the singers, and the porters, and the Nethinims. I had to look that one up. I didn't know what a Nethinim was. But these were helpers to the Levites that King David had appointed many years before. So the Nethinims were the assistants to the Levites, and they also went up. In the seventh year of Artaxerxes, the king. And he came to Jerusalem in the fifth month, which was the seventh year of the king. So, Ezra pops up here. And you see that between chapter 6 and 7, we have traversed, 50 or 60 years of time with no record here. But Esther fills in the record of this king, and the scriptures are silent on this period. But Ezra pops up here a generation later, and Ezra begins restoring the temple that had run into disrepair. That was his commission. Now here is the commission given to him. Verse 11. This is a copy of the letter that the king, Artaxerxes, gave to Ezra the priest. Verse 12. Artaxerxes, king of kings, unto Ezra the priest. 13. I make a decree that all they of the people of Israel and his priests and Levites, which are minded of their own free will to go up to Jerusalem, go with thee. For as much as thou art sent of the king and his seven counselors, and this was his commission, to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of thy God. Now that's a rather blank check. Take whatever steps you want to inquire for their welfare. Now it specifically says that you're to restore the temple. Verse 15, take the silver and gold back, and Verse 16, make for the offering willingly for the house of their God which is in Jerusalem, the temple. But then it says in verse 18, whatsoever shall seem good to you and to thy brethren to do with the rest of the silver and gold, that do after the will of your God. Now, Ezra was to restore the temple and then, with whatever he had left over, continue any other work he had in mind for the benefit of Israel and Judah. Now, we're going to just keep our finger here for a moment. Hope you don't get lost in the trend here. Keep your finger here. Turn back to the fourth chapter that we kind of skipped over. And we find out what Ezra did with that money that was left over. Ezra 4, verse 11. This is a copy of the letter that they sent to the king Artaxerxes in complaint about the work of the Jews. When Artaxerxes came, the Samaritans sent a letter to stop the work of the Jews at that time. And this is what they said. Be it known to the king that the Jews which came up from thee to us are come to Jerusalem, rebuilding the rebellious and the bad city, and have set up the walls thereof and joined the foundations. And they were alarmed, because once they would fortify themselves, they would be impervious to any further attack by the Samaritans or any further intimidation. So they wrote to the king and they say, if you search your records, you'll find out this was a very rebellious city. The king did so. He searched the record. He says, you're right. These folks have been hard to rule over the years. And therefore, he caused him to stop rebuilding the walls. But the point I want to emphasize is that Ezra did begin the work of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. With the extra money, he went on to try that, but he was later stopped. And finally, in the book of Nehemiah, when Nehemiah came along, he was given a decree to resume that work and build the temple and continue. Now, we have a small problem that we have to deal with in the book of Daniel on this subject. I've put here the years of the numbers that were of the years that were reigned by these kings. This is what pretty much all history concurs with. But if you compute this out, you'll find out that the date for Nehemiah's return would be 445 BC. Whereas, in the second volume, you'll find reference to historians which dated at 455 BC, 454, half a year off, but it 454, 455 BC. And it is at this point that it is suggested that the 70 weeks prophecy of Daniel should begin and count forward to Messiah. Now, if in fact history is not that way, but history is the way most historians have recorded it, then we have a problem that this date will not result in the proper application of the 70 weeks. Now, let me go back a little. I think that sounded confusing. It did to me. In the second volume, Brother Russell does not treat in detail this period of chronology. He merely says that while the historians say this date was 445, we think other chronologers specify 455, 454. But if you look in the Edgar's writings on the Great Pyramid, they do give you the reason for the difference in history here. And the difference in history is this king, Xerxes. Some historians say he did not reign 21 years, he reigned 11 years. And if you shorten his reign to 11 years, you start his son's reign 10 years earlier. And if that's the case, then his 20th year when Nehemiah went back starts 10 years earlier. And that's why you get Volume 2's date of 455 BC. And then that takes you 69 weeks of years later to Jesus' first advent. And that seems to work. The problem is, can we make that adjustment? Is it true that Xerxes reigned only 11 years? Or did he really reign the full 21 that most historians ascribe? We can answer that question from the scriptures. Let's turn back to the book of Esther. Esther, the third chapter, verse 7. In the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, there's the answer. Ahasuerus reigned 12 years at least. If you look through the passage, you'll find out that it even talks about his next year. So this king reigned at least 13 years. So if we have a question whether this king reigned 11 years only, or more than 11, Esther answers the question. Esther answers the question. I would just reference a reprint article here, a reprint 3659, where Brother Russell does deal with the fact that Xerxes was the same Ahasuerus that Esther refers to. Paragraph 1 on reprint 3659. He does not deal with, however, the problem of chronology. will also reference for you reprint number 3659, paragraph 0, and also reprint 4911, paragraph 3, where we read about Ezra's work, and it gives the number of years between Ezra and the decree of Cyrus. And that numbers he gives there does conform with the history that we're presenting here. But he did not discuss the problem of how to handle the 70 weeks. Now, we're going to give you a suggested answer how to handle it. We believe that history is correct, that Xerxes did reign 21 years. Now, let's go to the prophecy that we're actually discussing. It's in the book of Daniel, the 9th chapter. Daniel 9, starting with verse 24. Daniel was concerned about the future of his people, and so God gave him a prophecy about their final period of favor before their testing would be out. Verse 24, 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon the holy city to finish transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. And this was to begin from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem. Now, if we take the 70 weeks to begin the decree that was given to Ezra, and we date this according to common history, that would be 458 BC. If we go 70 weeks of years into the future, we come to a date of 33 AD. Now, if history really is this way, the 70 years does work. It just works a little differently than we may have supposed. The 70 weeks would take you to the complete work of reconciliation, to the anointing of the Most Holy, to the time when Jesus was crucified, resurrected, and appeared on Pentecost to atone for his church. So the figures will work if this history is correct. Time does not allow us to go into the rest of the prophecy and deal with some other specifics on this. We're going to have to return to Ezra. Ezra the 7th chapter is where we left off. Now, in chapter 8 of Ezra, we have a record of all the people that went back with Ezra back to Palestine. In chapter 9 and chapter 10, Ezra is back in the land, and he realizes that the people of the land have begun to intermarry with non-Jewish people. He's very concerned about this. He sits down in despair and tries to just consider what the Lord would have him to do. And in his despair and his discouragement, the elders of Israel come to him with a solution. Now, Ezra did not propose this solution, although he embraced it. But the solution was, we will put away our foreign wives and our foreign children begotten of them. Seems very harsh. Some people have condemned Ezra for this situation. It was not Ezra's initiation, but he did accept their suggestion. And they did put away their foreign wives. And you might think that with this severe lesson, they would never again fall back into this problem. But when you turn to the book of Nehemiah, 13 years later, they were intermarried and they had children that could hardly speak Hebrew again. There was a constant problem of backsliding. And with this solution of Ezra's problem, in the 10th chapter, the book of Ezra comes to an end. And that concludes the book. That's the record of how Israel came back to their land. We'd just like to close with drawing three lessons that may be helpful to us in this. For the first of these, we'd like to turn to Ezra 7, verse 10. Ezra, who had so much of a fervency for the Lord and to restore the true worship of his people and to guide them properly as a priest, as his duty was, did not happen to hear a chance remark about the Israelites, did not happen to stumble onto something that would alert him to the problem. He was not reacting emotionally and spontaneously. He had a decided course of conduct that he had premeditated and laid out. He had thought about his duties seriously. Verse 10, Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord and to do it, and to teach in Israel statutes and judgments. That's the way the consecrated life should be. It should be not only in response to strong stimulus that comes our way. That can be very helpful. But it should be more than that. It should be a thoughtful, planned out course of dedication and consecration. We should plan our circumstances, our employment, our education, insofar as possible, with a view to its long-range effects upon our activities, our study, and our independent time for fellowship with the brethren and for service to the Lord. Secondly, in the 8th chapter of Ezra, we read that Ezra had a little problem. You know that he took a lot of money back with him to restore the temple to its original condition. And some estimates converting the wealth that he had into our currency would be in the millions of dollars. Now, he's got to make a long journey. It took him 4 months to make this journey. You can imagine that traveling with a small band with millions of dollars, they would be subject to robbery and thievery. He was quite concerned about this. No problem, just ask the king who gave him the decree to go back to send an army with him. And he thought about that, but he couldn't do it. Verse 22, I was ashamed to require of the king a band of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy, because we had spoken to the king when he wanted the decree. He had told the king, the hand of our God is upon all them that for good that seek him, but his power and his wrath is against all them that forsake him. Now, having said that, oh, by the way, would you send a legion of soldiers? You see his predicament. But he was a man of faith, and his faith compelled him to go forward where the door of opportunity swung open. However, he did take precautions. In verse 21, it says, then I proclaimed a fast there at the river of Ahava, that we might afflict ourselves before our God to seek him of him a right way for us, and for our little ones, and for all our substance. And so sometimes when we reach a turning point in our decisions, in our lives, it's a time for really concentrating upon the will of the Lord, sometimes with physical abstinence, to place our minds and our hearts in a proper condition. You see that this example is certainly followed by the early church, not so much in the same fashion by the contemporary church. And we don't fault the church for that particularly. There's different circumstances and different times. But the principles here are just as valid of preparing our minds and our hearts, sometimes with bodily affliction is perhaps a bad word, it doesn't mean to cut yourself, but withdrawal of earthly good things, to put our mind in a state of being prepared to receive whatever answer the Lord would have for us or whatever providence or protection. But he didn't stop there. Then he proceeded on to take very practical measures. He divided the burden of the weight of gold and silver among 12 different divisions. He sent them out a little different ways so that if they were subject to thievery, only 1/12 would be taken. So, very practical thought. He had was full of faith. He trusted in the Lord, but he took all practical measures that he could take, just as our Lord said, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. And so likewise we must take all practical measures to carry out our consecration in the reasonable way that appears before us. And where we cannot guarantee the result, the Lord will step in and do his part on our behalf. And thirdly, the lesson of backsliding. When you read the prophecies of Haggai and Zechariah that were during the time that Ezra's book covers, you see the burden of their prophecies were about Israel's negligence, their backsliding. After starting the temple here, it took 20 years to get back to the job. And after completing it, it went into disrepair so that Ezra had to restore it again. And when you read Nehemiah, you find they had slidden backward again. And when you finally read the last book of the Bible, Malachi, you find that it's full of chastisements for backsliding. Well, it's not something that we can only look to the Hebrews about. That, perhaps, is the chief problem with the Laodicean church. The attractions of the world that will draw like strings and cords attached to us, pull us back out of the conscientious deliberation of our consecration vows that we hold as our ideal. We have to always be on the lookout against that. And a little experience, probably for most of us, certainly for myself, will express the need to watch for backsliding with all the attractions and benefits that we have physically. In closing, dear brethren, we're so pleased to have been with you. We do wish with you to emulate the spirit and devotion of the man Ezra, who was certainly a man of God.